Yes, now this is the fourth lecture on the topic, the God who is there and is not silent. And naturally, it is obvious from the title that it follows immediately after the first book, and that is the God who is there. So he is the God who is there, but it adds an entirely new concept to this, which must go along with the fact, as we shall see in this area of knowing, that he is not only there, but he is not silent. Now, as I said before in my lectures, and I know some of you are here for the first time to hear me lecture this time, I do assume that you've read my various books in the air so that you'll have terminology that I use without having to explain each time my terms and my thought forms. And I assume the facts in my present book are my older books as well. Now, in this whole book that I'm working with in this, in which these four lectures will constitute the heart of the book, I'm really dealing with the philosophic necessity of the fact of God being there and his not being silent. And those of you who only arrived for the weekend, you remember last night in the special meeting I had with those who had not heard me in the first three lectures, that I asked, please, if possible, that you get the tape and somehow listen to the first three lectures before you heard this one, or specifically, and very, very especially, that at least you listen to the third lecture before you come to the fourth. Because the third lecture and the fourth lecture really constitute one unit in comparison to lecture one and lecture two. So you remember that lecture one in this series, the first one, was the philosophic necessity concerning metaphysics. Metaphysics being the area of being, spelled with a capital B, as I pointed out, usually in our generation, being or existence. And I spoke of two things in that first lecture. First, the problem of the non-Christian position, or position, and then the Christian answer in the area of metaphysics. Lecture 2, you remember, dealt with man and the dilemma of man, that is, morals. And I dealt in the second lecture also with both sides of the question, the problems and of modern man and the rationalistic man in general, and then the Christian answer. However, when we came to the third lecture, the one immediately prior to this one, though it was several days ago, and we began talking about epistemology. And in the third lecture, we only dealt with the first half in comparison to the first two points, and that is modern man's problem. I will define at this time epistemology, just in case there's those who haven't heard any of the tapes or were not here before in the lecture. Epistemology equals the theory of the method or grounds of knowledge, or you can define it the theory of knowledge, or you can define it how we know, or perhaps most profoundly you can define it how we know that we know. I'll read it again very rapidly. Epistemology equals the theory of the method or grounds of knowledge, the theory of knowledge, how we know, or how we know we know. Now you remember we came to the conclusion in regard to the problems of modern man in the area of knowing, which is, of course, the most profound area you can deal with, into, once more, our diagram of the reasonable, or the rational, and the non-rational. And we saw that modern man is caught in a dilemma that down here you have mathematics, and man is a machine. Mathematics and man is a totally deterministic machine, a totally determined machine. And or you can say that down here, you end up with mathematical formula. You end up with mathematical formula. And you come into only cynicism concerning knowing. Because you've come past positivism, as we went over very carefully last time, positivism is dead. And positivism being dead is any hopeful thing in our own generation, the era of epistemology, as a result, this being the, because positivism now is agreed to be wiped out, which was the rationalistic man's hope at this place, All you do is end with mathematical formula and with cynicism concerning knowing. Now, up here, on the other hand, you remember I point out that it isn't very good up here either in this total dichotomy, because up here you have no categories, because categories are concerned with reason. So reason is related to categories, categories to reason. So if by definition you split the field of knowledge into the area of reason and non-reason, as all modern men have done on this side of the line of despair, if that is the case, there isn't reason up here, and not having reason, no one has shown how there can be categories. So down here, it's a real hell for modern man, not just in morals, not just in the drug world, all these other things that are so obvious and visible, but in the area, the most profound thing, of simply knowing. Down here, you end up with cynicism in the area of knowing, with only mathematical formulas, and even cynicism as to the object down here, and with the death of positivism, and up here with no category. Now you remember further that I pointed out that the categories that modern man has lost, and which modern man knows he has lost, is first of all, in this upper area, there are no moral categories. Just quickly say again, Antonioni's blow-up is the most perfect expression of this that anyone could give. You have murder without guilt, but love without meaning, in Antonioni's own statement about blow-up. So what you have then is that there are no moral categories. And this is very obvious. It's the thing which those of you who are younger, the thing which bugs your parents most of all in the younger generation, it is very obvious that there's a loss of moral categories. But it is not only the loss of moral categories, as bad as this would be, but far more awful, it is the loss of human categories. It's love without meaning. But we must remember that you cannot stop there. We moved in our last lecture on beyond blow-up into the last year at Marienbach, Fellini's Juliet of the Spirits, The Best One, The Hour of the Wolf, novels, Rendezvous, another movie, Belle du Jour, and so on. And that is, modern man has not been able to stop, even with the awfulness of the loss of moral categories or of human categories. He has been swept on into the place where he has no categories to distinguish reality and fantasy. He has none to distinguish reality and fantasy. And here's where you come to The Hour of the Wolf, Belle du Jour, etc. The Fellini so on and making very profound statements. There's no categories upstairs, even so that you cannot tell, with or without drugs, the difference eventually between illusion and reality. So you suddenly find man is in a very special kind of an awfulness of the loss of the difference between any certainty of the difference between reality and fantasy. And any idea of fantasy suddenly threatens him. He is overwhelmed in the threatened being threatened by fantasy, because he cannot be sure where one stops and the other begins. The best statement of this certainty was Fellini's Juliet of the Spirit. So what you have is no distinction really between the inner world, that is the mind, and the outer world. Modern man is losing this and has risen far out to say this. We can see the results of it over and over again. The loss, with or without drugs, of any category to be sure of a distinction between what is in the mind and what is in the outer world, or at least to be sure with any accuracy. Or to be able to distinguish what is in your head with what is in the external world. This is where modern man has come. But you remember I pointed out that it is even one step worse than this in the fourth area of which I spoke, and that is the loss in the upper area, the loss of any concept of category, and that is the terrible question of then, in this kind of a world, how do you know other people? How do you know other people? How are you really going to get from outside into their head? How are you going to get from outside into their head? And you remember I spent a lot of time covering this point. Let me review quickly over this last point, and then we will go on from there. But you remember, because it is crucial, modern man's dilemma is far deeper than merely the sociological one, merely the drug problem, merely the moral problem. It is epistemological. And in the midst of all this, this is not theoretical, it is deep and profound, And for those of you who haven't wrestled with it and don't understand it, you must understand that the modern generation who is really in it is a hell beyond all words except the real hell that lies in the future. It is awful and it is terrible to live in this area. Now, we've seen, therefore, and I'll go very, very quickly because this is a review of the end of Lecture 3. I had to hurry it too fast anyway last time. There's a fourth group of categories involved. The first, moral categories. The second, human categories. The third category for reality and fantasy. And fourth, the fourth is really knowing other people. In other words, the third group of categories is concerned with moving from inside the head to outside the head with certainty and being sure there is any difference. But in reverse, the fourth category I'm now talking about is how can two people ever know each other, in which they must move from outside into the other person's head. This is the dilemma, most of all, of modern man. And if you wonder what young people are, why they're so disturbed at certain points when you hear them talking about knowing other people, this is the reason. And I remember I used an illustration at this point. But before I give the illustration quickly again to say some other sentences to point this up, how do we have any categories to enable us to move inside the other person's thought world? This is the modern man's alienation. This is the hell that so many modern people face, of feeling totally alienated. They can sleep together for 10 years, 20 years. It doesn't make any difference. But how do you get in each side of each other's head to know anything about the other person as a person in contrast to merely a language machine? How do you do it? How do you do it? And this is a very special and deep form of lostness. Then you remember the illustration of these young people who came to our place and who'd been living together and had a baby. And as they came into the chalets there, they talked and talked and talked deep, 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 deep into the night. They had known each other for a long time physically, and yet they talked all the way up to daylight, every day until they drove everybody absolutely out of their minds. And you remember I said that I became curious, and naturally and later I followed it up. What are you talking about? What are they talking about? And I am glad I really got to know them, and we had a very open, very much of an open empathy later, because it taught me a great lesson. It was the lesson really of the final, what it means to lose the fourth classic category of how do you move inside in the person's head. Because these young people were talking all night long, trying to find one exhaustive phrase, one exhaustive sentence, how to begin so they could be sure that they would know the person inside. It was awful to watch. Awful to watch. But this is our generation. You don't have to be a freak in order to really be caught in this dilemma. Not really. So what you find in this situation, they were talking, trying to find one exhaustive sentence, one exhausting phrase, so they could begin. They had no universals in their system, and there was nobody else there to speak, as far as they were concerned at that time, except themselves. No certainty of God, no certainty of anyone else there to speak. And with no universals in their world, they had to find a universal that they could make by a totally exhaustive point of contact. And, of course, being finite, they never found it and continued night after night seeking for this one word that would make the total breakthrough. How do you begin in such a situation? Obviously, you're left only with particulars. And moving outwards, you have no certainty that anything is really there outside. But moving inwards, you're trying to move into somebody else's head. How do you know that you're touching them? Human beings, as I just said, are the only ones that are there as far as they are concerned. There's nobody else in the universe to speak. As far as they're concerned, in such a situation, if you don't find the exhaustive phrase, how do you begin? You can't just begin with knowing something partially. It must be exhaustive because there's no one anywhere else, any place, to provide any universal. The universal must eventually be in the area of your own language, in the area of language, and you're on make a universal in the area of language, in your own conversation. In one exhaustive sentence, one exhaustive phrase, and this is the true generation gap, as I said, in the area of epistemology. Here we are. This is where it comes from. You remember I went on and finished with these sentences. Modern man is left as either downstairs the machine with words that do not lie lead either to value or to fact.
but only to language, only to words. And that's true. That's where modern man is after the later Wittgenstein. That's where he lives. Language, modern man's language leads and does not lead either to value or to certain facts. Modern man's language and linguistic analysis finally only leads to language downstairs or upstairs to a world without categories in regard to human values, moral values, or the difference between reality for fantasy. And I said that in my conclusion, do cry for the modern generation as you see far how far we have come. Man made in the image of God and meant to be in vertical communication with the one who is there and who is not silent, and then to have horizontal communication with his own kind has come in his because of his own proud rationalism, because he has made himself autonomous to this awful place I have just described. You remember the ending of the way I ended completely with the last lecture was moving over and quoting from Satyricon, and which you remember in Fellini's Satyricon, if you have seen this movie, just a horrible statement of all with where it leads. Fellini really understands the awfulness of where this leads just as well as, let us say, a man like Fellini. And here we find in this Satyricon, you come to maybe the crucial moment of the film where the hero, the man who is a hero, really the anti-hero, of course, but where the man who is the central character's friend has died. And he comes out there and they have had such hope as they began as young men. What tremendous visions they had as men, as young men. And they had proceeded across the classical world. And it stunk beyond all measure. And finally he was killed in the most absurd situation that Kafka could ever have pictured. And he was killed in the most absurd situation that Sartre, Camus could ever have pictured. And he was just killed and there he was and the whole thing was wasted. And the central character goes out and he looks down at his friend. And this final sentence in my talk here, it isn't quite final in the film, but stands at the climax of the thing. What you have to say is, it just rings in your ears. And it is translated into this place where we have put it in this lecture. It does stand properly as a statement, an epitaph for modern man. And that is that the main character looked down to his friend and says, "Oh God, how far he lies from his destination now." Tremendous, tremendous thing. This is where modern man has come, and is taking autonomous stance. Now the Christian answer. There is a Christian answer to the epistemological problem, and we will now consider it. In order to understand why there is the Christian answer, and more than that, why there is no problem to be answered from the Christian position, which is more profound. It isn't just that Christianity has an answer to the epistemological problem, it is that there is no problem to the Christian. And in order to understand that, let's go back to an area that I assume you've already wrestled through with care in my books, and that is the problem of nature and grace. Let us remember, in Escape from Reason, in The God Who Is There, I went back and covered the problem of nature and grace back into the past, especially Escape from Reason, and we find that humanistic, rationalistic man, after Thomas Aquinas and the birth of the nature and grace dilemma, had no answer for the nature and grace problem. But in contrast to that, you remember in Escape from Reason, I showed why it was that the Reformation had, when it was consistent to itself, that the Reformation had no such problem. Why did it have no such problem? Well, you must understand that the thing that makes this very, very distinctive and shapes it up with a strong hand is the interesting factor that these things were happening almost simultaneously. In general, we can say in the South, there was the Renaissance, the High Renaissance, in the North, almost simultaneously, the Reformation. And yet, as these things burst forth into the world, we find that one was strangled to death gradually by the nature and grace problem, while in the North, the Reformation, when it was true to itself, really never had a nature and grace problem. And I'm assuming now a real knowledge of Escape from Reason at this place, the book. And you remember that I pointed out that the reason the Reformation had no such problem
was because it had revelation. So it never had a nature and grace problem. The reason it didn't have any is because it had the Bible. And this is the difference. In other words, the place upon which rationalism stands by definition, and that is man beginning from himself, although he's finite, and going out to connect enough particulars in order to make his own universal, and saying there is no knowledge from any other place, or I reject any knowledge from any other place. By definition, therefore, he is led into this problem. But on the other hand, Christianity, coming and accepting the propositional factual revelation, never had the problem. The historic Christian position had no nature and grace problem because it believed in propositional revelation. And revelation deals with language. And immediately we remember, of course, what we saw in the last lecture, that the great thinkers today understood, or in our ear understand, that eventually the discussion and the answer, the lack of it, will fall in language. And we can think of the later Heidegger, and we can think of Wittgenstein in this place, in the things which I covered. So we find that at this particular point, Wittgenstein, Heidegger understands that the thing will eventually turn upon language. Wittgenstein understands, Bergman understands in his film Silence, that there's a real question, and the only basic question, and that is there anyone there to speak adequately? And these men had no one there to speak adequately. And having no one there to speak adequately, we're left with Wittgenstein's absolute bankruptcy as he moves in to linguistic analysis. We're left with Bergman's Silence, that after he makes the film Silence, for a while he said, I can't make any more films except comedy, because I am so crushed and I am so overrun. Actually, of course, he has made new films and carried it on into The Hour of the Wolf, which I say is the film closest to it expressing the same thing as Juliet of the Spirit. You must understand the Reformation had no dichotomy between nature and grace. Why did it not have a dichotomy between nature and grace? Because it had propositional revelation in which God tells of himself and which God tells propositionally of history and the cosmos as well. This is the reason they had none. This is the reason. The Reformation and the Judaistic Christian position in general says that there is someone there to speak. And we're told that he speaks indeed in two areas. And the reason the Bible has no nature and grace problem is because, taking the areas of nature and grace, and I assume you know what I'm talking about here, in the third lecture, I went over the definition, but I don't want to again. You must understand that the Bible, that eventually you come to universals and particulars. Now, the Reformation and Christianity in general says, there's a unity binding these together because God has spoken in both areas. So the area does not come because of autonomous man being wise, but the unity is there because God has spoken propositionally and factually in both areas. So there is no problem. There is no problem. He has told us both things. He has spoken of himself truly, and at the same time he has spoken factually and propositionally in the area that is open to verification and to discussion and to falsification. So therefore, this being the case, we have a unity of nature and grace on the basis of what God has said. Remember what this lecture, these series of lectures are and what the book is going to be. He is there and he is not silent. We have a unity on what basis? Of propositional revelation. Rationalism, by definition, could never find an answer because God speaking. Because God speaking gives the unity of what is needed, and autonomous man, in his revolution against God, has made this indeed as his base, and that is, he will find out for himself. He will find out for himself. Now, I define nature and grace in the last lecture. You can pick it up there, of course. Maybe the best definition, the quickest ones, early on in Escape from Reason. But eventually you must realize that regardless of whatever you deal with, eventually you end with universals and particulars in the nature and in the grace discussion and problem. Now let's ask a question. thinking of this and seeing that indeed, now remember we're still under the heading of nature and grace, and then we'll pick it up and apply it into the area of knowing and epistemology. But is the biblical position intellectually possible? Is it intellectually, if you can keep intellectual integrity and hold it, namely that you have no nature and grace problem because of the reason I have said. And so you must understand, you must say something like this. And that is, no, the biblical position is not intellectually possible if, on the basis of a certain if, the Christian position is not intellectually possible. You cannot hold it with intellectual integrity if. What is the if? You cannot have, it is not possible, you cannot hold it with intellectual integrity. If you begin with the worldview of the uniformity of natural causes in a closed system, it cannot be done. If you are infiltrated by the modern monolithic concept of our consensus of the uniformity of natural causes in a closed system, then the Christian position can never be held with intellectual honesty. Somehow or other, you must flee upstairs in such a case. And that just as true if you begin with a naturalistic theology as if you begin with a naturalistic philosophy. It makes no difference whatsoever. No difference whatsoever. A naturalistic theology beginning way, way back a couple hundred years ago in Germany, going through the old form of the old rationalistic theology, changing its form slightly but not changing anything basically with Karl Barth, and coming up to the modern existential theologians, on the basis of this whole wide area of naturalism, you cannot, with integrity, hold the Christian position, intellectual integrity. It cannot be done. If you accept the presupposition of the uniformity of natural causes in a closed system, then indeed the Christian system is nonsense. And the only way to hold it in words is God words, in some upper story, mystical thing. One more trick. This is your worldview, the uniformity of natural causes in a closed system. And in faith, you dogmatically and stubbornly refuse to consider the possibility of any other presupposition. Even though your naturalistic worldview leads to a dehumanization of man and is against the facts that we know about man and we know about things, because the only way I would insist that you can hold the naturalistic concept of the total uniformity of natural causes in a closed system is against those things which are about us, and especially your knowledge about yourself. But if against these things you in faith dogmatically hold to your uniformity of natural causes in a closed system, if you do this, you will never, 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 never be able to consider properly the other presupposition. But understand something. I would insist that you're holding it in blind, dogmatic faith against the facts. You're holding it in dogmatic faith against the facts of the universe that is there and its form and what man knows about himself. But if you absolutely insist to be this man holding the uniformity of natural causes in a closed system against the observation of the universe and its form and the manishness of man, if you insist on doing this, then you will never, 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 never be able to see Christianity as an intellectually possible thing, because you've ruled it out by your presupposition. You'll never be able to face the possibility even of the presupposition that science began with in the first place. Because you remember over and over again, I insist in my book, and quoting Whitehead, quoting all these men, the science did not begin where modern science is. Modern science began with the uniformity of cause and effect in an open system or in a limited time span, depending how you want to word it. They did not begin. Copernicus, every man from Copernicus on, for a long while, up to Newton himself,
They did not believe in the uniformity of natural causes in a closed system. Science was born out of the uniformity of natural causes in a limited time span in an open system.
But if you hold the other dogmatically, even though it means the complete dehumanizing of man, and even as though it means looking out here and having no answer for the complexity of the universe as well as its existence. Now here, remember the first two lectures, metaphysics and morals. If you do this, then of course there's no place for revelation. In such a case, there is no place for revelation. No place. But notice you're operating not on facts, but on an insistence on your presupposition. Now, the interesting thing at this particular point in our own time of discussion and intellectual discussion is the fact that modern secular anthropology, within relatively last few years, has accepted almost universally a new definition of the distinction between man and non-man. Secular anthropology today has almost entirely accepted that the difference between man and non-man is that man is the verbalizer. It didn't used to be this way. It used to be the toolmaker, but now it's the verbalizer. It's the verbalizer. So therefore, modern man has concluded by observation that which makes the difference between man and non-man is that he is the verbalizer. What is a verbalizer? Well, we communicate propositional communication to each other in spoken or written form in language. That's what it means. Indeed, we must insist here, and I'm not insisting now as a Christian, but as a man, and through the observation of our study of ourselves, and as men have looked at themselves, and as we can look at ourselves, indeed, the only way we think in our heads is on the basis of language. The only way we think in our heads is on the basis of language. Not just communicate with others, but with ourselves. We can have other things in our heads, but they must be linked to language. Outside, a book can have much vigorous speech, much, much vigorous speech. But the figure of speech must have a continuity with the normal use of syntax and defined use of terms. Or nobody knows what the book is about. Nobody. So consequently, man is the verbalizer, and man is not only the verbalizer, but it's clear that we need to think in these terms, in our head, and in our communication with other people. This is what's meant by the verbalizer at this place. Now let us, looking at this argument, therefore, from the non-Christian viewpoint of the modern man's view of the uniformity of natural causes in a closed system, here, of course, all concepts of revelation, and especially verbalized propositional revelation from God, is indeed total nonsense. But the point I try to make in my previous books, and in this one, and in the previous lectures, and in this one as well, is that this presupposition will not stand up to examination. It fails to explain man. It fails to explain the universe and its form. And it fails to stand up above everything else in the area of epistemology. It really does. Here I want to put in a parenthesis, because here I have no problem, I hope. But in England I have a hope. I always have to define my use of presupposition. I have found that a fair number of people in the intellectual community in England use the word presupposition slightly different than different than I mean it to be taken. To them, a presupposition is always, by definition, that which shapes you below your consciousness. That's not my use of the word presupposition. I believe the way I'm using presuppositions, you choose your presupposition. Just this little parenthesis for someone here who's wrestling with these things a bit deeper. Now, Christianity offers an entirely different set of presuppositions, or you can say an entirely different presupposition. It begins with a God who is there, who is an infinite personal God, who has made God in his own image. He has made man, above everything else, to be the verbalizer in the area of proposition, in his own head and to other men. Now, this then, assuming, starting with this set of presuppositions, or this presupposition, in this Christian structure, is it unlikely in this structure, unlikely that this personal God, who is there and made God in his own image, and made man to be the verbalizer so that he can communicate horizontally to other men on the basis of proposition and language, Would it be then unthinkable or even surprising if this personal God then communicated to man, to us, in the language of on the basis of proposition? And I just want to say I put this question, after careful definition, to the sharpest atheists I've ever met across many, many continents, in all the great universities. And I have never, 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 never had an atheist who didn't say, you're right, this is not only is it no longer unthinkable, it would not be surprising. The question is God there? There is no other question. And has he spoken? Then so. But you must see that this is not now unthinkable. Now you must understand something else intellectually at this particular place. And that is, we must always think of units of things to be judged as the unit. You cannot mix these units across these great flowing things and get anything that makes sense. So Christianity has to be judged, first of all, upon the basis of what it is as a unit, just as the uniformity of natural causes must be judged also on the basis of what it is under its own apex of the beginning of everything impersonally, and that everything is to be explained by the impersonal plus times, just chance, etc., etc., etc. So here, coming in the light of the Christian structure, of course it is reasonable. Propositional, factual revelation is not unthinkable or even surprising in the Christian framework. Let's bring it down to something a little more definite. If a personal God has made us to speak to each other in language, if the personal God has made us to be language communicating beings, why would we be surprised that when Christ spoke to Saul on the Damascus Road in the Hebrew language? Doesn't God know Hebrew? What in the world is surprising about that? Nothing anymore. Nothing anymore. And if the personal God is a good God, why in communicating to man in revelation would it be surprising that he would communicate what is true truth in all the area in which he communicates? No surprise left to it anymore. The surprise all left when you've been infiltrated to some measure by the uniformity of natural causes in the closed system. And every bit of surprise you feel rests down in some place of brainwashing you got somewhere, either from the little golden book long, long ago, up into your university professor. And this is where it comes from. This is where the surprise comes from. There's nothing surprising about it. It has only been surprised if you've been infiltrated by the presupposition of the uniformity of natural causes in a closed system. And then, of course, it's not only surprising, it's impossible. It is a question of which set of presuppositions really, and I'm going to choose the next word with great care, really and empirically answers the problem and the fact that confronts man. That's the real discussion. So what we find in the Bible, is that in the Bible, the answer rests upon language in revelation. The Bible has no nature and grace problem because of propositional revelation. That's the reason it has no nature and grace problem. It's why the Reformation, as long as it was anywhere, as long as it was consistent to itself, never had it. The nature and grace problem only came in to the Reformation North when it began to no longer be consistent to itself. That's when it re-entered. The amazing thing is that Heidegger and Wittgenstein, the two big names today in the area of modern epistemology, also both saw that the answer would be, one way or another, would be in the area of language. But they had no one there to speak, and so the understanding of the need of language damned them. This awful silence, that Wittgenstein felt. The awful silence Bergman pictured in his film, Silence. Christianity calls upon us to begin asking whether there is someone there speaking. It then says, that God has told us about himself, truly but not exhaustively, about history, about the cosmos, not exhaustively but truly. And then on this basis, there was no nature and grace problem. Now let's move over and see that just as the Reformation had no nature and grace problem as long as it was consistent to its own self, so there it's a parallel exactly, and we can begin to understand why Christianity, rightly pursued, also has no problem in epistemology and in knowing. Christianity has no problem of nature and grace, and let me say very gently also, Christianity has no problem of epistemology either. It is not that we happen to have an answer, but rather there is no problem in the Christian structure. You remember now, I'd like to make a parenthesis here for those of you who heard me in the previous lectures. It's exactly the same. The Christianity has no problem in the area of unity and diversity either. It has no problem in the university and diversity either. And they understood this in 325 at the time of the Nicene Creed. They had no problem in the area of unity and diversity because they looked down, they saw what the Bible said, they saw what they already knew to be the case, namely the existence of a Trinity, that God was on the unity and diversity in the high order of Trinity, and they had the answer to the Greek problem. Next notice, I'd like to make a point here that I made there. It's not like Jim Price said. Jim Pike said that at this point Greek thinking came into Christianity, and the Trinity was only born out of Greek thinking at this place. He had it completely backwards. It's that the Greek thinkers had nicely defined the problem of unity and diversity in the beginning of the 4th century, and the Christians suddenly looked down to what they had already believed for a long, long time concerning what the Bible taught about the Trinity, and they realized they had no answer, they had no problem, they had the answer. Very reversed from the thing Jim Pike said. Beautifully reversed. It's exactly the same here. Exactly the same. Now, coming into the area of epistemology. It's not that we happen to have an answer, but rather that there is no problem in the Christian structure. Let us be clear why we have no problem in the area of epistemology. From the Christian viewpoint, we must return again and deeply grasp, really deeply grasp, that which Oppenheimer and Alfred North Whitehead has said about the birth of modern science. I'm going to repeat it again. I've done it in every book because I think you have something here that you must get ground into your bones, not only to be able to memorize it, to hand it back in an exam someplace, but to understand really everything that's involved. And what did Oppenheimer say? What did Whitehead say gave the birth to modern science? And that is, they simply said that the birth of modern science was because of the Christian surrounding consensus in Mueller. Why? Number one, because on the basis of the Christian consensus in Mueller, the Copernicus and so forth had no problem about the external world. They came here in the Christian setting, and they knew God had created a world external to himself. Secondly, something even a bit more, and that is, and Alfred North Whitehead has said this expressly, and that is, the modern science began beyond the incidentally, but suddenly modern science was born. Why? Because in their mind, in their thinking, in their whole set of their mind, they understood, to quote Whitehead, because the universe had been created by a reasonable God, it was not surprising to find out that the facts of the universe could be found out by reason. And modern science was born. It was born at this point. Now then, looking at this, as I've stressed over and over again, modern science as I use it, no longer has it. They gave it up. And they try to put positivism under it instead. And positivism has been destroyed. And today they have no basis for understanding that there's an objective universe there at all. And I went in a long, long discussion last time on the question of positivism. It's Pliny dealt with it, and as I tried to deal with it slightly differently, you remember. The point of the trouble is, the difficulty is, that modern science no longer has a base, either the original base or the theoretical base of all the forms of positivism that tried to change and change up to logical positivism and finally came to an end. Now, as I've also stressed, I don't believe for a moment that now that the base is gone, the science will not be changed. I believe it will be changed. I think we're watching the change of science, because men no longer have any, either a theoretical base like positivism, let alone the sufficient basis we had in the beginning of what gave birth to modern science. They no longer even have a theoretical base of science. And I don't believe for a moment that if men back there had had modern man's philosophy of life, science would have ever started in the modern sense. I just don't believe it. And I believe something's going to happen, and it is happening. Science is becoming only technology. It's only technology on one hand, and it is open to complete manipulation on the other. Why? Because modern man has no base any longer to be certain of the objectivity of the thing he gives. Now, I urge you here, if this interests you, to turn again to the church at the end of the 20th century in my chapter on modern manipulation on sociological science. My point simply is that science, I don't believe, would have ever started if modern man, if man back there believed what modern man believes, and I don't believe it can continue as it's been going on now that he no longer has even a theoretical base for it with the death of all the forms of positivism. Now, when we carry this over, then we're talking about the birth of science and the change that has come, that the birth of science, let us especially Alfred North Whitehead's thing, let us carry this over now into the area of epistemology. We find it's an exact parallel. And it runs like this. This is the reason the Christian has no problem of epistemology. The same God, who is an infinite personal God, who exists, and who is not an abstraction, made a reasonable world. Up to here, you see, I'm following Whitehead. Made a reasonable world. Not only, however, the things may be found out by reason, but the things stood in relationship as he made them. He being this kind of a God, he made certain things to stand together just the way we do when we make something on the basis of that which is reasonable. Exactly the same. What you're doing here is taking Alfred North Whitehead, he's not a Christian, but he had a right observation here, and surely this should be the Christian's position as we read all that Paul says and all the rest, and now I'm just extending it into the field of epistemology. So he made things, and we know the early scientists could step out in certainty that they would be able to find out truly something about the universe by reason, because a reasonable God has made it. But if a reasonable God has made it, we should not be surprised that then when he makes things to go together, they'll be together. And they say it's simple. Simple. You write down the whole part of the subject-object dilemma. He made the external universe, which makes true science possible. But he also made man. And he made him to live in this universe. That's what he made him to live in. So we have three big factors standing together. First of all, the infinite personal God, the personal God, made the universe. It's not an extension of his essence, but it's really there, and he made it in a certain way. And then he made man to live in that universe. Not another universe, but that universe. And then he gave us the Bible to tell us about that universe. We have all three things together. He made that universe, he made man to live in that universe, and he gave man, gave the Bible to man to tell him about that universe. The Bible, again to repeat, this verbalized, propositional, factual revelation to tell us what we need to know. And in the Bible, he not only tells us what we need to know about morals, which makes it possible to have real morals instead of just sociological averages, he does not even just tell us how to go to heaven, as wonderful as that is through Christ. But in the Bible, he also gives us comprehension to correlate our knowledge. The Bible's tremendous. The Bible's tremendous. The liberals have destroyed it, but the evangelicals have sold it short. Just exactly what we've done. The Bible was given to us not only to tell us how to go to heaven, but to how to correlate our knowledge. We needed this special revelation, and he gave it to us in his love and in his grace. The reason Christianity never has had the problem of epistemology is exactly the same as the reason why it has not had the problem of nature and grace. And that is, the same reasonable God
has made both things. That is, he made the knower and the known. He made the subject and the object. So what would you expect? They didn't come by chance.
If you have the concept that they're coming by chance, of course, how do you know what basis you have they're going to fit? But when the same God made them, are you surprised that they fit?
Why shouldn't they fit? So it is not surprising if there's a correlation between these things. It is what we would expect, because we have a reasonable God who made them in the first place. And there's a reasonable correlation between the subject and the object. Between the subject and the object.
Now let us notice, if this is against our human experience, then such a statement as this is purely a leap in the dark. It is one more Kierkegaardian leap without any meaning, an upper story thing. It is stronger than this. If this is against human experience, it's pie in the sky. One more form of pie in the sky. But is the Christian position against human experience? The answer is absolutely no. It runs the other way. Interestingly, this is the experience of all men. The old men of the past, the men of the present, the men of the east, the men of the west. Wherever it's the simple man and the complex man, it's the experience of all men. It does not matter how theoretically unrelated in his philosophy man is. In reality, he lives as though there were a correlation between the subject and the object. It does not matter who the man is. He lives as though there is a correlation between the subject and the object. Its simple fact is, it is not possible to live in any other way for 2 seconds in this world. And you remember my illustration of God is film, where he wants to picture something really unrelated in modern man's thinking, really representing modern man's philosophy of the haphazard in the universe. And so he pictures, and random in the universe, so he pictures people going out through the windows instead through the doors. But as I pointed out, what he doesn't do is to show people going out through the solid wall. He simply doesn't. No one lives that way either. No one. So when the film, The Hour of the Wolf was being ground out, it didn't make any difference. I'll tell you, the cameraman ran the camera frontwards and not backwards. The fact is that if you're going to live in this world at all, you live in it acting as though there is a correlation of yourself and of the thing that is there, even if on the basis of your philosophy there is no basis for that correlation. Now please begin to remember Polanyi's arguments against positivism. You can see how this begins to fit together. So Polanyi argues against positivism in this place, and he destroys him magnificently, but he ends the cynic because he doesn't have this answer. So just exactly as all men love, even if they say love does not exist, and all men have moral motions, even though they say moral motions do not exist, so all men act as though there is a correlation between the external and the internal world, even if they have no basis for that correlation. So down in the area of epistemology, we're exactly where we are in the more superficial realms we have covered in the books that have come out, in the tapes that have come out, in the lectures you've heard through these last years. We're in the same place. But no other system, except Judeo-Christianity, the Old and the New Testament together, tells us why there is a subject-object correlation that you do and you must act upon, and all men act upon it, and it's only the Judeo-Christian position that tells you why you can act upon it, but all men act upon it. It's not against human experience, it's in line with all human experience, but it's only the Judeo-Christian position that tells you why. The same thing, we're coming down in the same groove as was true in the area of metaphysics and the area of morals. It's not the best answer, it's this answer, or absolutely intellectual death. Complete intellectual death. In other words, we must say that all men must act in this definition now. Just this definition I've made in this rather tight circle. But in this rather tight circle, all men act every minute of their lives as though Christianity were true down into the hard stuff of knowing in the subject-object relationship. Now, let us go further. And though man is different from other things, that is, in that he is made in the image of God, in contrast to, let us say, the plants and the animals and the machine portions, such as the, say, the energy particles of the universe, yet nevertheless, as we've said over and over again in these books, and remember in my first lecture that I gave, I pointed out that what we're doing is just, in one way, there's only one book. And all these books fit together, and we can see how really overwhelmingly marvelous the Bible is in its answer. Christianity is truth, and if it's truth, it is not just doctrinal truth, though we are doctrinal men, but it must touch on the whole scope of that which is before us. And it does, as we move across these fields, field after field. So now we are coming down, and indeed, we see again that man is different from the other created things in that he is made in the image of God. Yet, nevertheless, in the area of creation, on the side of God's infinitude, and his finiteness, on that side, he is equally a creature, as I have always said, with a hydrogen atom. We're fellow creatures. We're fellow creatures. We're a creature as much as the hydrogen atom is a creature on this side. It follows, therefore, if we are a creature and these are creatures, these objects before us, if this is so, and that is, though we are separated then from them on the basis of personality, yet because we are fellow creatures in a common world, we should not be surprised at these proper relationships as God made them that way. Something very beautiful. Overwhelmingly, we should be filled in a way with awe. This is the lecture that, above all other lectures, really gives me a tremendous feeling of awe in the presence of the God. Not the unknown God, but the God I know because God has not been silent. You remember, if you studied my book with any care, on ecology, pollution in the breath of man, the Christian view of ecology, it turns at this point. And you remember in my basic argument concerning a Christian view of nature, which was the original title I had for the book, and that is that these things which we face, they are not made in the image of God if they are not man indeed. The tree is not made in the image of God. The fish is not made in the image of God. These things are not made in the image of God. It is true, but I must treat them properly because they are fellow creatures with myself. I am different from them on the sense, in one sense, of being made in the image of God. On another sense, that I am a fellow creature with them. And if this is so, I must treat them properly on the basis of the way God has made them. Don't you understand that what this point is in the area of epistemology, which is the most profound area of intellectual study that can be followed, don't you understand that it's only moved one more checker mark on the board? And that is, if these things are fellow creatures with myself, and on that basis I am to treat them properly, then what we must take is the next move and move it. It is true, if this is so, and I am fellow creatures with them, if this is so, then we must understand that it is not surprising that this fellow creature, being made with me, as I have been made by the same God, the same reasonable God, and that object out there being made by the same reasonable God, he has made the subject, he has made the object. If this is so, now we take the extra step. In ecology, we must treat it properly because God has made it and I am a fellow creature. But in the area of knowing it as a fellow creature, and I am not surprised that I can know it. And know it truly. Really know it truly. So as we bring these things together, and in this book in some way I feel the whole series, in all the books that can be written, but nevertheless, in this series it brings it all together in a very tight line. Do I treat the subject? Do I treat the object properly? Surely I should. It's made in the image of God. But now I'm not surprised if the same reasonable God made it. But I'm not surprised at all that he's made it so I can know it. This is the reason. Not at all surprised. In epistemology, we know the thing is there because God made it to be there. It is not an extension of his essence. It is not a dream of God. It is true objective reality. And so it is there. And we are not surprised to find there is a correlation between the observer and the observed because God made them to go together. And then this phrase is important for the 20th century.
They were made by the same God in the same frame of reference. That's the term. If you're taking notes, you must get on your book. They were made by the same God in the same frame of reference. Are you surprised? Were we not made to live in this world? The Christian does not have, then, the problem of epistemology. He is not surprised that the tree is there. And more than that, he is not surprised. He's jolly well not surprised that he can't walk through the tree if the tree is there. He's just not surprised. And the man who is not the Christian, may not know why he can't walk through the tree, but he still doesn't walk through the tree. We know not only why it's there, but why we can't walk through it, because it's made in the same frame of reference. Angels can walk through trees. Now everybody has to face this truth. Whether it is the very intellectual man who hates the gospel, really hates the Christian view, or the very simple man who lives as though the Christian view is true because he acts without questioning why. The very simple man acting without questioning why, as though knowing that just acting as though there's something there, very simply, and as though there must be a correlation because he doesn't expect to act to walk through trees. But whether it's this very simple man or the most sophisticated man you ever meet, who knows all about idealism, all about the concept, philosophic concept of ideas, everything you can ever study about philosophy, one thing will be true between them, and that is neither of them are walking through trees. And Sam Johnson can kick the stone and make fun, and his argument has no weight. Why? Because he had no Christian base to put it on. That's why. When he kicked that stone and he said, that just proves idealism, he proved nothing, except he wasn't as smart as Boswell thought he was. But when you come down to this and on this Christian base, it's an entirely different thing. People don't walk through trees. Now let's go further. The Christian says, of course, on this basis of all things being made by a reasonable God, my having to treat them properly, if I have an understanding of Christian ecology, but now an understanding of Christian view of epistemology of knowing, I know why it's there, I know why there's a correlation, what do you expect? It's natural that it's so. Why? Because the reasonable God made it just this way. Now, when Polanyi destroyed positivism, which he did with an expert touch, if you ever want to read any destruction of anything, beautifully done, is Polanyi's arguments against positivism in the book I gave him title of last time. But where was he left? He was only left with utter cynicism. Cynicism about what? Poor Polanyi was left with cynicism about knowing. But the Christian, is not in this place. He is not in left in regard to the subject-object relationship in this place, because the same God made them both, and therefore the correlation between them is never to be taken as a surprise. Now, at this particular place, we must come down into think of how accurate is our knowledge? How accurate is our knowledge? I've lost in my notes, but I want to add something here, somewhere here. And that is, you must understand, it's the same area of, let's move it over into the physical realm. Here I am, I have a lung structure, and the dog has a lung structure. Why does my lung structure fit into this universe, and the dog's lung structure fit into the universe? The man who merely begins by chance will never come up with a good answer to this one. Never, never, never. But the Christian, you see, is not at all surprised. The Christian is made to live on the world and not on either Mars, or not on Mars, nor neither on Venus, nor on the moon. The dog is not made to live on Mars, Venus, or the moon. 20 years ago, we'd have been talking theoretically. Now we know all about pressures on Mars, pressures on Venus, and we know all about pressures on the moon. We've seen people walk up there. You don't walk on the moon for very long unless you've got a big pack on your back.